With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Racket Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, offering iconic tracksuits, classic polos, and the new Youngline sneaker. Originally designed in the mid-1980s, it's our favorite spring silhouette, and it's back. You can get it now at sergiotacchini.com and follow them on Instagram at sergiotacchini_official for updates. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout, and you'll get 30% off your order.
Caitlin, how are you?
I'm good. You're on the road.
I am on the road. I've been on the road for a couple of weeks. I was doing a little bit of work with Jeannie Bouchard and around all the very responsible female tennis players. Lots of great couple of events that we've had, and the tournaments in Charleston and one just recently in Lexington. And, you know, they've been great. They've been really fantastic.
Well, I have a lot of follow-up questions for that, but that's going to have to wait until you're back here in New York, because there's so much to unpack in those very few sentences you just talked about. But the task at hand is to introduce someone you were able to catch up with in Charleston at one of those exhibitions you were just referring to. And she is, of course, Victoria Azarenka, former world number one, Grand Slam champion, mother, fascinating person. Tell me a little bit about the backstory of how you guys sat down.
I got to tell you, you know, you and I have spoken a lot about, you know, some of the people we'd really love to get. And Vika's always been on our list of players for so many reasons. And I think what everyone's going to hear in this podcast is somebody that maybe they don't realize that is very deep, very, very, we all know she's emotional. She always showed her heart on her sleeve when she played, but I think what she's gone through over the last couple of years with the ups and downs, obviously having a fantastic couple of years and winning, you know, back-to-back Australian Opens, and then, you know, the surprise of getting pregnant, and then having to the next year and or so after that dealing with custody battles and having to almost hide her emotions of what she was dealing with through that time is very evident in this podcast. What you don't see is what I saw on Zoom, which was someone get very, very emotional at one point. And yeah, she's just a really great introspective person, and it shows in this podcast.
A couple of things to listen for in this show that I was really, really struck by when I was listening to the audio was, number one, her son Leo is very heavily involved. So if you want to hear what that guy's verbal skills currently are up to, you can hear him doing a little guest chatter here and there. And the other thing was, you know, Vika, I think, has always been to me somebody who has had a lot of depth, and she's always had a lot of interest in various music, art, culture, ideas. She's lived in the States, I think, for a long time. And to hear her talk about the Black Lives Matter movement was really interesting as well. Like, that's not something you necessarily would bring up as a topic for her to dive into. And she did, and she spoke about it really earnestly with a lot of passion and heart, and in a way that was really moving. And so it was really interesting to hear her talk not only about the past and, you know, the future of what tennis has for her, but also the present.
Yeah, I think one of the great things throughout this whole process is that Vika, I think, has grown as a person after having her watch, you know, the last few years. But you're going to hear it very much so on this podcast with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to have this woman on
the Racket Magazine podcast. She's down in Florida, and I just got to see her in Charleston where she played a couple of matches. It's been a long time since she's played a lot of matches. We have former world number one, multiple Grand Slam singles champion, Vika Azarenka. Vika, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So this is a fun podcast. So we don't have to get all serious. You can even swear if you want. But I mean, you know me, so I'm never shy with that stuff. I
guess let's talk a little bit.
I'm going to let you talk as much as you want, believe it or not. So I want to know, Vika, like, you know, coming from Belarus, I guess, how did you start? Like, how did you get into tennis?
Well, I started when I was 7 years old by coincidence that is pretty much, I think, shaped my life. My mom started working in a tennis center, which had nothing to really do with tennis. Neither she knew anything about tennis or we had any connection whatsoever to tennis. And I was just coming from school after my school to see my mom because it was just right by our house. And then she just like gave me a racket to distract me. So I would let her work. And I went to this like a little gym and started to just, you know, mess around a little bit and get myself busy with a racket. And a group of kids with a coach came in and they had their lesson and they asked me if I wanted to join. And I was like, no, I'm scared. And I ran away. And then my mom brought me back and I started to, you know, it was really fun kind of way to start because I had like 40 kids in a little gym. So it's super crowded and we didn't start anything on the tennis court. It was just like all the games, you know, touch with the racket and coordination and, you know, thinking back to it, it's like, that was my first introduction that kind of
we were driving here.
Helped me later on to understand like the feel of the racket, the touch and, you know, the coordination and being able to do different things. So it was really fun and I wanted to join after and then it was history. I never left. I was all constantly playing on the court on the wall because that's how I started. And I was just very, very passionate right away.
So what was your mom doing at the club?
She was just working like an administrator, you know, just like letting people in and I had nothing, absolutely like zero to do with tennis.
Oh my God, that's so crazy. It's amazing to me how many players, you know, either talked to or interviewed, how random it is that they got into their sport. I mean, Mary Pierce, for example, said she only started playing at 10 and she went with a friend to the courts and said, that looks like fun, and decided to go on the court at 10. So I guess that's a good thing for parents to hear because it's like, you know, you hear these parents that get their kids into like Saddlebrook or like, you know, IMG or Mauritaglou at like 4 and they're like getting their kids in. It's about, I guess, what you're saying for you, it was about having fun with your other friends and peers, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, being a parent now and understanding kind of the concept, I think that also I've been pretty aware of the situation, even with my own fellow peers, like my age, that how much pressure there was coming from parents, you know, to go and make it. And it's like, I see when I see a 7-year-old with a personal coach and a fitness coach, you're like, dude, seriously? Like, just let them be kids and let them enjoy and have fun. Cause that kind of burns out after 14. And like, you always question, is it for, you're doing it for the kid or you're doing it for your own reasons, you know, and trying to push them to be who you want them to be. And so it's always pretty sad. And like, I mean, we have our like our ways of motivation, I guess, and inspiration why we do what we do. But I feel like once you lose the passion and once you lose fun, if you're doing it, it doesn't really take you that far. Takes you, you know, to a certain limit, but it doesn't necessarily fulfill your full potential. There is, and for kids, it's really tough to see that, you know, just how much pressure there is from coming from parents. I watched this documentary, Trophy Kids. It just like it pictured it so well, and I was able to talk to, his name is Peter Berg, the way he captioned this whole moment, it basically is following four or five sports. It was tennis, golf, football, American football, and basketball. So four sports, four different kids, different cultures, different everything. And it's just insane, like how much, first of all, this was already on camera, so the people were aware that it was on camera. So I can only imagine what was going on behind the scenes. And what he did incredibly was picture while the parent was talking, the kid's reaction up close, and you can see everything. And it was just like, I actually have seen those kids when I grew up. And one thing I'm very lucky about is like my parents never made me feel that way.
You know, I've never heard that story from you personally. Like, I've never asked you that question. Somebody asked me the other day, like, what's the most important ingredient you feel is for someone to be a successful athlete? In your opinion, then, like, sort of looking at it from that perspective, for you, what's the most important thing that they have?
Well, I don't think there's one. I think everybody has kind of their own strength and their own weaknesses. So I think it's about like finding your strength and really make that drive you, and then always learning how to make your weaknesses stronger. So I think it depends on the person, but something that it probably stands out from everybody who makes it is the ability to go past no, past I can't, past you won't, you will, like you just make those into kind of a yes type of situations, and to never give up. I think that's what really makes a champion is, you know, you can be talented, the hard work definitely has to be there, but something that goes beyond that is ability never to give up and turn your no's into yeses.
So the refusal to lose is kind of more important than wanting to win.
I will say that, but it makes it more about the result, and sometimes it gets tricky. I think it's more about like the process of actually staying in the moment and going, you know, no matter what. So I think it would mess with me a little bit more if you just think about the result and not actually doing that. I think you lose that, you know, the moment in the present. But finding it, you know, finding that kind of being in the zone and being actually able not to let anything bother you, I think that's really hard.
Yeah, it's funny. My answer was, for me, you had to have passion in the end. Like, it's sort of what you're saying. Like, you as a parent can push your kid so far, but if you don't have the passion for what you're doing, then it's really hard to be super successful in the long run.
I think we've seen, like, you know, with examples, they are very rare examples, but you do see the people who are not passionate and they're just really good at it. It's just really a matter of like, was that fulfilling you? Was that everything that you could do? You know, and I mean, reading Book of Agassi, like I had to close it because as soon as I heard he hates tennis, it was like, I don't know if I want to read about it. You know, that.
Did you finish?
No, I didn't finish it, but that really turned me off, and I'm a huge fan of him, but kind of hearing that, I understand why, but it just at that point when I started to reading, it was like mentally I don't really want to go to that place to listen.
Finish the book. It's really good in the end. I cried the second to last page, and you'll know why if you do finish the book, because I think I know
the story without even the book. So I understand like everything that happened, but it was just like that approach didn't resonate with me from the way I felt before. And I have this feeling like when I meet, you know, people that I really admire, sometimes I'm scared to meet them because if like you kind of see the real person sometimes and you're like, I can't be a fan of them anymore or the other way around. So I'm always very, very nervous about that.
All right. So that's interesting for me because in some respects, like when you were coming through, you had, obviously you had your first success in Grand Slam play when you actually won the US Open mixed doubles in 2007. Randomly, I was there that day and I remember it when you won it and you were so young and it was like this moment. But you were always really hard on yourself early on in your career.
Yeah.
Where was that period of time, though, that went from sort of that period of 2007, 2008, of having success and winning some slams young in mixed and then having some doubles success and then eventually, obviously, in 2012, winning the Australian Open and 2013? What changed for you in that period of time? Because I think it was more, for me, from watching you and knowing you and playing against you, for me, it was more emotionally, like you were so much more level as a person on court. What was the difference maker?
Well, obviously, the difference is learning from your experience. A lot of times people think like, oh, your success came like super fast, and if you look at it from kind of numbers wise, the age that I was at and everything, it does seem, pretty significant. At 16, I was playing full on tour already. By 17, I was, I think, top 50 or something like this. So it feels like it was quick, but to me, it felt so long, like, especially after juniors going, from being pretty much undefeated. And I pretty much was undefeated in junior, especially my last year. I won 6 out of 8 Grand Slams, singles and doubles. I lost like 2 matches in a year. So
that's okay.
That's okay, right? And then you go into playing, qualifyings in 25s and 15,000, and you get your ass kicked, and you're like, fuck, am I that good? I was just unbeatable, I was the shit. And now it's like you're winning, and then someone just outgrinds you, and you're like, they're, your ego starts to get hit so much because, like, they're not more talented than me. Like, they have some, like, bad shots and whatever. That's what's, like, going through your mind, if we're being honest. And you're like, how am I losing these matches and stuff? So that felt like, that was, like, a process for me to get into, like, okay, you gotta fight no matter what. Doesn't matter who is on the opposite side. And it was really about, I think, from starting to 17, is like, you're not losing to the opponent, really. You're losing to yourself. So why don't you try to eliminate one more opponent? You just have one. Don't make 2 opponents, when you go out on the court. And I think that was helpful for me. But again, it's like, before I won my first Grand Slam, I was ready to, like, stop because I wasn't feeling passionate. I wasn't feeling like... I'm fulfilling myself. It was just a lot of grind. And it's like a lot of, you're basically kind of skipping your whole childhood. Sometimes you were like, unsure, am I doing the right thing? Am I happy? Am I not? And for me, I always play, with my heart. If I feel good, I play good. And I think it shows, it really shows. That's one thing that I think people do notice about me is that passion that I bring on the court. I bring my whole self is there. So
I feel you.
Yeah. So it's, I think that was like, starting, to kind of learning from your experience, taking like bad hits and some bad losses, losing like four finals before I won my first title. Was very like painful, but it was really monumental for me to kind of go again. And then, I felt like after that, there was very few finals that I've lost after I got to the final. So I think that also kind of shaped my mentality going into that last match. Is like, okay, this is the most important stage. You know how it feels the other way. And so I think it's all about learning experience, and it's like you have to be ready to have that success at some point. Sometimes people get success, they're not ready, and it kind of goes sideways from there. And
just on that subject, like, look, we've seen a number of players win Grand Slams and really struggle afterwards. I mean, yeah. I will say that the one thing that I have always and said about you when you won your first Australian Open is that you were one player after Serena in particular, after Venus, after Serena, after those, great Grand Slam champions, Lindsay, Kim Clijsters, who would win a slam and never looked like they were like, all right, I'm just going to mentally kind of shut down for a little while because this is all too much for me. Like, and you know what it's like when you win a slam. Look, there's tons more press. There's tons more pressure on you. There's way more expectation. Everyone thinks you're supposed to do it again. You know, and it's not easy. You've got social media. You've got all this extra stuff on you now. But you are one player that I thought handled it as well as anybody I've seen in a long time that actually one wasn't good enough. Like, you were one player that wanted to consistently get better the next Grand Slam and wanted to win the next Grand Slam and wasn't afraid to win the next Grand Slam. I mean, that's unique. Like, what made you that way? Look, you had your injuries after it. We know the story afterwards, but I felt that you were one player that actually really truly believed they belonged in finals and winning Grand Slams.
Well, I think, you know, it goes back to from, you know, how I grew up and everything that kind of put the foundation. And what I said is, like, sometimes people are just not ready for the success. And I don't want to take away anybody's, you know, victory away from them. But when you don't win and constantly play on the level, beating top 10 players and making it far to the tournament, just didn't make that extra step, it seems like, well, we didn't expect that from that player. I think the way I played and before I won the Grand Slam, like, I was expected to win already the Grand Slam. Like, I kept showing the results that it was really close for me making it there. It wasn't a surprise. And we've seen some, you know, examples of players who were, I don't know, don't win a match for like 6 months and then all of a sudden play amazing tennis and they fully deserve that win because they were the best at that time. But I think that's where consistency is lacking a little bit because there isn't consistency before. So how do you expect the consistency to be after that? Is a little bit questionable. So, and then with all those things on top of that, that adds to it is like, you know, that makes it even harder than the first time. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was like, I love that feeling and I always love the pressure. If I don't have pressure, like, I really don't see myself playing at all. Like, it's not fun. Like, if I'm bored and there's been some tournaments where I'm like, oh God, like, I just don't feel like going. And it's not because, okay, you have to like overcome your own stress. It's just like, I just don't want to go out there because I don't feel like playing. It's not going to be fun for me. It's not going to drive me to, like, you know, to go that extra step. So I'd rather get myself ready for big events. And for me, it was always about big titles. It was always about big tournaments, big events, big opponents. So when that pressure came with being number one and you kind of having your target on your back always, it was uncomfortable, but it was that what was driving me. Like, it drives me to feel like someone wants to beat me, someone wants to be better than me. So
explain
the competitive side.
And explain uncomfortable.
Well, uncomfortable because sometimes you just gotta work harder. Like, in the way that, you know, you and even if I wasn't number one, when I wasn't number one, I kept feeling like somebody goes out there and they're like, they're gonna play harder than they play against somebody else. And you're like, why, man? Like, why? And I remember that particular actually match. I was playing in 2016. I was playing Miami right after I won Indian Wells. I was playing Monica Puig in second round Miami because I was seated.
At night, I believe. Is it at night?
Yeah, it was night match. It was night match. It was like 9 p.m. And I was like, okay. And I was having conversation with him and he told me like this and that, you know, and this and that. And then I go out there and she just hits the shit out of every ball and like playing like unbelievable. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, what the hell did you tell me before the match? Like, have you watched the matches before? Like, I mean, it's a different player for what you told me. And I have never played against her before. So he was like, Mika, like, I'm telling you, it was like a completely different match. I'm going to go take that match and I'm going to show you. And I said, well, I don't know what you did, but this was like, this was another player from what, like completely different from what you told me. So he was like, I don't know. So that was kind of like what I felt a lot of times and with a lot of players. So what I'm saying about being uncomfortable is being able to accept that, you know, kind of that next step. And we see that with not a lot of players, but few players who does experience that same kind of, I would say, target on their back. And obviously when you become, you know, top 10, and obviously everybody do want to prove that. But what I'm saying is, like, even if you're not top 10, you still kind of have that, mm-hmm. that feeling, you know, when somebody plays against you, they kind of extra want to win.
Yeah. Did you feel like when you got to number one and you won the slams that you had to, not that you always are working hard, but do you think that you were trying to add even more things because you knew the target was on your back and people were going to try and just like do whatever they could to beat you? Was it more the mental side, or was it more you needed to keep adding things to your game to even stay at the best? Because, I mean, there was a period of time there in 2012 and 13 where you were so good.
I mean, the thing, I think physically and, you know, tennis-wise was something that you have to just constantly maintain. You know, the thing with being mentally is like you have to constantly adjust, and that's kind of the beauty of our sport is there's always an adjustment. Like, no matter how good you are, how good you feel, there's days that you always have to adjust to conditions, to circumstances, to opponent, to whatever. So that I feel like that was something that was helping me being there, you know, consistent, mm-hmm. being able to adjust to situations. And, you know, like when people say, oh, you played so well 2013 Australian Open, I felt so bad that whole tournament. Like, I felt like I can't put the ball in the court. I was so uncomfortable. I felt like I had no timing on my balls or anything like that. I was just not. But I'm winning matches and I'm finding the way to win matches. And it definitely wasn't the way I was playing. It was just me finding the way to win and finding the way to, in a way, like, destroy kind of my opponent. Because I think it was the third round in that year where I almost lost to Jamie, the American girl, I forgot her last name. That match was like, I was about to be packing home, like, because I was just not feeling well, my game at all. But somehow I stuck in there and I found the way to win.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? I mean, you, when you look at people, how they win a Grand Slam, they don't win them easily. They have to battle through a lot of matches, and not everybody's Serena sometimes just walking through a tournament winning in straight sets. And even Serena's had some tough matches.
There is always a match that is going to almost send you home before you like pick it up on another level. So,
this episode of the Racquet Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, revitalizing and disrupting the status quo since 1966. Follow them on Instagram at @SergioTacchini_official and go to SergioTacchini.com for more. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout and you'll get 30% off your order.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
exactly. Look, you obviously had a couple of tough years with some injuries in 14 and 15, but when you had the Sunshine Double that you talked about when you won, and then obviously, surprise, surprise, everybody, I'm pregnant. Like, yeah. I mean, that time of your life, like, can I ask you, like, legit, like, what you thought when you realized that you were pregnant at that time?
I was obviously a little bit shocked, but it was a really tough time for me during that period. After the Sunshine Double, it was very, very difficult time for me and my family, because I just found out my mom had 4-stage cancer. Mm-hmm. And me coming back and not even knowing like what was going on was a huge shock for me. So when I found out I was pregnant, I wasn't sure what was going to happen. It was like, oh, I'm never going to play tennis again, probably, and then like everything, like you have options of, different situations. And it was like, it happened in Wimbledon. So I was like, oh, I don't know. Like I probably need a week to figure things out and make a decision. So it was obviously a very tough choice, but I wouldn't change it for the world for sure. And now we have spit here. This guy is going. Does he look like me?
Yeah, he looks like you. Because this is a podcast, people can't see it, but we've been joined on the podcast by Leo.
By Leo.
How much did that, you have your trials and tribulations after that? We all know sort of like the difficulties that were coming from, dealing with the relationship as well. And it's been very well documented that you had to, had to struggle with the custody battle. It's been a tough couple of years for you, but can you put into words like the last few years as far as like the tennis and, the custody battle and Leo? And it's, you've had to deal with a lot of stuff on your own, and you're obviously away from your family. You're in the US, they're not often. I mean, can you put into words like how difficult the last couple of years have been for you?
I mean, in a few words, it's kind of impossible, to be honest, but but I think, I've been always very protective of this side because I don't really wanted to talk about it so much of what was going on, because I'm very self-aware that, the stuff you post on the internet is going to be there. Mm-hmm. And I don't want Leo to be, reading this stuff after or having any kind of a record, because for me, it's the most important is always having protect him over anything else and my family. So to say that it was hard is, understatement. I think that, being on the court and playing sometimes was a miracle that I actually went out there and I was able to kind of like, put myself together and people wouldn't know what's going on. So, and I don't ever look at it as what you've been doing is actually really difficult. Like, I'm like, okay, well, this is what I gotta do. I just have to go out there and I have to perform. And then you hear, oh, she's not the same, she doesn't play as well, she doesn't, like, that was unnecessary extra to kind of deal with, So, it was hard. It is still hard. And
I think the important thing for you is that you never, for me growing up, you were never poor, poor me. You never want to be poor, poor me, feel sorry for me. You're always so self-motivated to be able to go and give 100% every time you walk on the court. And this is what you're so admired by for on tour with other players. But also knowing you, like, giving 100% is always been your number one thing, but But I think it's normal also for people to know. And I think one of the things that I love about this podcast and having people get to know these tennis players is that you're all human, right? And you've got things that are going on that nobody sees behind the scenes. Yeah. Of course, you're a public figure and you don't want things out in the public. It's very hard not to tell your story, to be like, yeah, but listen, you know, you want to just go and play and you don't want to get asked these questions all the time. But it's also, it's your life, you know, and it's not easy. And performing on a tennis court in front of 10,000 people and you being everyone expecting you to be at your best is not easy.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I look at it as like, okay, learning experience, right? Because that's what I've always been. That's what made me, I think, you know, the champion that I am, and is learning how to get out of the situations that are been in front of you. And that's kind of been, you know, something that keeps pushing me. Like, I mean, everybody have their own moments of weaknesses and stuff, but like, I know that no matter what, like, I'm never gonna give up, no matter how good or bad I feel. Like, I will, you know, be sad for a moment, but then I'm gonna keep going. So, you know, the situations like this, I've definitely grown so much as a person compared to, you know, as a tennis player. And people, when you go to the tournament, it's like people look at you as a tennis player. It's like the human side doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's like you play and you win or you lose, and that's what you're defined by, kind of. And that's fine, but you know, you have your own like self-evolution that you go through. And then, you know, you answer like these questions that I understand this is part of the job. It's like, so where are you when you were in 2012, how far you've come from there? And it's like, you know what, like super far, but all you get judged by is like, yeah, but you won that year, and this year you lost in the first round or a second round or a third round. But that's, there's like some things that are a little bigger than what it is, you know. And I see with like some other players who are playing and maybe not showing their best results because of whatever reasons that they might be going through, and people are like, you know, just retire. Like, what are you doing here? Like, the fuck do you want? Like, why? Like, what is your business? Why I'm playing, or why am I doing what I'm doing? And it's like, why? Why is that somebody's problem? Let me be me. Let me do me. And to other people, it's just so much like so much judgment and so much, you know, like talking and stuff for no reason. And that's like, that's where the point is. Like, I feel like sometimes you're like, you don't want to go back into that. Like, I love tennis, I love competition, but all that bullshit around is just you don't really want to do that. And I'm not at the point in my career where like, let me prove you this, let me, like, I don't gotta prove nobody nothing. I've done more than a lot of people will be able to do in their lifetime, but it's not about that. It's just about like seeing like how sometimes just damaging, you know, that type of attitude, and especially for like young players who are just coming up and, you know, dealing with like stressful situations. It's not easy. Like you like, that's where my like mama bear type of part comes in, is like the protective side, you know. So
you feel like, I mean, I've known you a long time, Vika, and you know, I think I told you when you came back and I saw you for the first time, and I said this to a lot of people around me, there's no question that you changed when you came back. That you were, I mean, don't take this the wrong way, you were definitely more a mama bear. You were You talk more, you seemed a lot more relaxed. And I think it was all for the better for you, because you also recognize this is your family, like out here with the players, or, you know, with Serena and being, you know, her being a mom as well. Like, I think you were relating better to everyone. And I mean, for me, it was like, you're like a totally different person in the best of ways. And I think you eating and doing what you're doing with all this stuff going on in your life is a miracle, you know, and it's amazing. I'd love to see you out there playing. I mean, what did you learn? What was the most, you know, last thing on this situation? Like, what was the thing that you learned the most about yourself? And you're still learning because you're still going through a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely feel like, you know, that kind of a soft side of me that always been there, but been covered by many layers of hard-ass experience opened up. And, you know, it's like, I was just having this conversation today with someone and they said, like, your kids, you teach kids stuff. And I always say, like, how I feel is that my kid is teaching me everything. It's like they're kind of being like a flashlight, you know, into the darkness of your own self. And they're just pointing out, oh, look, oh, there's something over there. There's something over there. So I definitely learned how to be softer, how to, you know, not be only thinking about yourself, because that is not existent anymore. When you have a kid, like, you stop thinking about yourself at all. And it made me feel like from a different perspective, you know, from kind of trying to understand people better, being more aware about other situations. What are you doing? What the deal is? And patience a little bit, that I still don't have a lot of.
I think you have great patience. No, it's
with him, I actually do, like, with, it's just like with myself, you know. It's what actually it also taught me is like how strong I can be for somebody. So I'm learning how to be as strong for myself in a way, like relearning that stuff. But it's a lot of things changed for me, honestly. Even in 2015, the way I was on the tour, and it feels like there's just, unfortunately, there sometimes you are around people that feel the need to protect you, and I'm gonna, because people don't understand, don't see my quotations. Protect you.
Air quotation marks, right?
Shield you from everything and everyone to kind of feel control over you, you know, to manipulate you into whatever situations. And I've had that, and I felt like I've been, in a way, isolated from anybody and everybody, you know. And I, not necessarily that much, because it's very hard to put, like, isolate me completely because of my personality, but I felt that I wasn't close enough with the players, especially with people around, because, you know, we're all busy, we're all doing our stuff, but we're still around each other, and we still need to find a way to communicate with one another and just be nice. So from that moment, it kind of like opened up my eyes, and I was able to be more more open and be more myself, because for a few years I was really, you know, closed and like didn't really want to be connected to anybody. But after that, it really helped me to open up, and I enjoy being in that, you know, in this type of energy and connecting with people. So, but it's, you know, it's, there are some people around, you know, tour in your life that are, unfortunately, are not a great influence. And we have to experience that to know better and how to, you know, move past that.
And also to see it. And it's probably a good thing for you to see it. Maybe you're going to be that great influence over somebody one day and be like, maybe you should just watch out for that. Because I can see you being an amazing mentor, like in your older years, not yet. You still got a while to go.
I think that's important. I hope, like, you know, players and some older players who have their experience sometimes share that with younger players, so they have kind of an understanding.
That is Vika telling Leo not to use the headphone caps.
Yeah.
But on that note, Vika, like, you are being really great over the last couple of months with social issues, like with, you know, really getting behind Black Lives Matter. You reposted Coco Gauff and said how, you know, you go Coco. And I'm sure that's the mama bear coming out in you as well. And you did, you know, a bunch of stuff for the frontline workers with COVID. And I just see you really, you're trying to be a macro view on the world now. And has that changed since obviously having Leo? And just trying to take that, knowing that you are a voice and it's important for you to use it in the right way.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's really about like fine balance, because, you know, there are things in the world that happen and you just can't ignore them, and you live in the same world, you know. Something like thing with Black Lives Matter is a really difficult subject for me to understand. I'm from a different country and I've never had any experience like that, and it's been a difficult you know situation for me to even understand. And I had this conversation one time with Serena actually, and I understand, like, I can never understand that emotion, just the emotion of like just hating someone because of their skin color or whatever. Like, it just doesn't, like, I can't even understand that. So, you know, going beyond like understanding what people are feeling, I can't say what I can't say that I understand. I absolutely can't. But, you know, I just want to be helpful where I can be helpful, no matter what the situation really is. It's like, if I can help somebody to do better or to be better, why wouldn't I take the chance to do that? And unfortunately, like, with sometimes with people, use, you know, some people, when you say something, they use you as a front line for their agenda, if it's good or bad. So sometimes you just like you feel like, oh, do I want to say something? Do I have a backlash? And it's like this stuff with the social media backlash, you know, from, it's like, it's extra. Just be nice, try to be helpful, listen sometimes more than talk, you know, and then just do your best in anything. And, you know, and I hear sometimes like you help somebody with this, and then somebody else comes, oh, well, you didn't help us with that. And you're like, well, I can't be everywhere all the time.
I've got enough issues.
I just like, you know, like it sometimes it's just overwhelming, because even if you do good, it feels like sometimes it's not enough, or like, you know, it's not, but you know, you still gotta keep going and stop dealing.
So Vika, I mean, you know, I'm going to bring it up just because, I mean, why not? But you know, the retirement world, I mean, that is far from your thought process right now, I would imagine, because I see you still playing.
I can't really say that because I wasn't even sure I was going to come and play again. I honestly haven't touched my racket since September until February, and I really wasn't sure if I'm going to play. So I can't really say that I'm not thinking about it. I haven't thought about it sometimes. I just keep, you know, I want to try to play again, because I really feel like I can still do and I can learn. As soon as I feel like I can't learn anything, I cannot go further. I think that's where it's going to be a moment for me. And that's kind of it. You know, it's like self progress. When self progress stops on the court, because, you know, in life it will never stop. I'm going to keep trying to play. Yeah. And I honestly thought I would never play past 27, but here we are. So yeah, we'll see. I just don't want to predict anything, because I feel like every time I say something that's going to happen and nothing happens. So
yeah. Well, I can tell you that, I mean, for God's sake, I want you to keep playing for as long as you have the passion and you love it, because, you know, you're a great rare player in the fact that, you know, I'll say to even with Jeannie last week, and we were watching you play, and I just said, you know, Vika is such a good role model for every young player to watch, because every point is at 100% capacity every time. Whether you win or lose the point, it's your passion for giving your best is, it's a rare thing. And a lot of players get very upset and they, you know, play one or two bad games and they get down on themselves. But you've always been such a great role model for these young kids. And so I just hope you keep playing, being happy, because that's super important for so much of us that love to watch you play, keep doing.
Yeah, that's really, like, you know, what I'm working on, is like to find that balance to go out there and just enjoy, because it's been a while since I had that feeling, you know, and it obviously shows with the results and stuff. So, you know, finding myself that, you know, going through this difficult times, is I feel like in the end, the reward of that and that feeling to regain that back, that's what's going to be worth it. So that's why, you know, kind of going through this tough time is important for to be able to appreciate it probably more after. And I think, you know, when people, like, I remember people asked me, like, how does it feel to win your Grand Slam? And honestly, my first feeling was relief.
Yeah.
It wasn't like joy or anything. It was just like relief, finally. Like, and you don't think about, oh, I just wanted, it's just like all of those bad kind of days and those tough moments, that's where you kind of relieve, and then everything else shows up. So, you know, I feel like when you do have that success, is built on a lot of failures. But definitely it's like, it's hard to, you know, appreciate when something is given to you, and rather than something is you really earned. And so,
well, I don't know, maybe this crazy time with COVID and not being able to play and spending time with Leo and, you know, getting all of that sort of settled in your life is maybe a blessing in disguise, that maybe a lot of players don't like everyone else is chomping at the bit. Maybe it was a good thing for you to step away and be told you can't play. And maybe it'll reevaluate how you feel about going forward, whether it's to play on or, you know, to spend the family life that you want to now and make something of that. So maybe it's a blessing in disguise either way with you.
Yeah, I think so. I think that is, I mean, no matter how hard it is to think now, it's just, it definitely makes you pause and think about things that, you know, you kind of blame on being busy and not being able to address that. And now it's like, well, you've got all the time in the world. So let's see how you feel today. And then we'll check in back tomorrow. And then I'm still going to be here the next day. So might as well talk to me.
No excuses. No, listen, Vika, I don't want to keep you much longer, because Leo, you have been very patient. And I want to thank you for giving Mom up for a little while so she can talk to us in the podcasting world. And Vika, I just want you to know, I just adore you. And, you know, I've watched you grow from this young, skinny, little precarious, an incredible woman, an amazing mom. And
come on, I'm still skinny.
Definitely still skinny. But, you know, I want you to keep playing as long as you have the passion and you love it, because there's very rare athlete that's come along like you on the tennis tour that gives as much as you do. And I know that the last couple of years has been tough, but you have come through it as tough as anybody I know. So thanks for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'll see you soon, Renee.
You better, I better see you soon.
And that's it for this episode of the Racket Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Rogerian and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.